Welcome to the One Last Sketch Podcast, a show dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and history. I'm Michael.
I'm Marie.
And I'm Corey.
This is episode 40, one that's been a long time coming because we have been promising to review the graphic novel by Jeff Smith, Bone, for a very long time now.
Yep.
And we have finally gotten there.
Just when most of us don't really remember it anymore.
Bone is a comic book series. You can get it in multiple formats now. It originally was self-published, coming out in individual issues. Then it was picked up by Scholastic and came out in a 9-volume series. You can also get it as one giant omnibus volume.
It's really more of a tome.
Yeah.
Like, when you hear the word tome...
It is over 1,000 pages long. It was published in installments from 1991 to 2004.
Mm-hmm.
It is about three cousins who are bone creatures, which are these cute-looking, smooth-skinned, sentient beings who are driven out from their hometown called Boneville and end up in the valley, where they are caught up in an ancient battle between good and evil. And while Phone Bone is the protagonist, you could say he's not actually the main character insofar as being the character who has the most development.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He's probably just your observer, largely, I'd say.
I think you could argue in many ways he actually has the least development, because he's fairly consistent throughout in that he's just a legitimately good person.
Yep. Yeah.
Unlike his other cousin, Phony Bone, who is terrible.
Hence his name.
Well, Phony Bone is a scam artist at heart, so...
Yeah. And Smiley
and
Bone.
And Smiley Bone, who is an agent of chaos.
Yeah, also, there's that one bit where it's like, he's not as stupid as he lets everyone believe. That's about it.
He's kind of a weird mix between sidekick, comic relief, and force of chaos, as you said. Like, he's very much there, doing his own thing, but his own thing sometimes interferes with everyone else's.
He's the tallest.
He is the tallest. I think it's also worth pointing out the difference in the art style. Most of the other characters are drawn fairly naturalist in this, and like they actually look like humans, whereas the bones legitimately look like old-style cartoon characters.
I think ease of drawing might have been a driving choice for the bone design.
We'll be getting to that.
Yep.
I don't think there's much argument to say this is the most important and influential American comic book that came out in actually a very important period in comic book history in the 90s and 2000s. But at least for our generation, this is a pretty towering... work that a lot of us have read, or at least a lot of us who are geeks have inevitably read.
Yeah, Michael made an original everyone's read Bone comment to me off recording, and I was like, that's definitely not the case. But everyone who might possibly listen to this podcast has probably read Bone.
What's funny is, I didn't read it till about a year ago after you guys browbeat me into it, and my initial reaction was, oh my god, why did it take me so long to listen to them?
Yeah, it's almost like I make good suggestions and stories.
What? No.
Yeah.
This leads into how did we come to Bone?
Mm-hmm.
Corey read it a year ago because we forced him to.
We were totally going to podcast right then and there, guys.
No, so we should backtrack a little bit on my part. I was aware of Bone before that. I used to work in a bookstore right when they were being re-released in colored versions because it was originally black and white. I didn't think anything of it at the time. And then you guys actually read it and told me it was good. Mm-hmm. So when I finally actually listened to you and read it, I was adamantly agreeing with you and kicking myself for taking so long to get to it.
Yeah. Marie?
When did you read Bone?
Okay, well, your actual first question was, when did I first encounter Bone? And I think I actually first encountered Bone when I was a teenager, I had some younger cousins who were reading the colored versions, and they had them over once. And I remember kind of leafing through them, and I thought, this was like a good comic. I mean, it was not long after I'd been reading like Asterix and Tintin and those kinds of comics, which are obviously like very different generation. But I was kind of like, oh, neat. It's like an adventure story and there's like sci-fi. And I think I didn't pick them up because I kind of forgot about them, or I saw that they were in a lot of different volumes was, I think, the other thing. And I didn't want to like have a whole bunch of volumes of comic books. This was way before I read Sandman or like things where you'd get many volumes of a graphic novel. That idea was not a concept I was familiar with then. But then in university, I think Corey and I were probably like on one of our chapters dates where we'd like go to the bookstore when chapters was still a thing in Canada, and we'd just like look at books and buy them. And I saw the which I currently have here, this copy of The Bone Tome, and I liked, when I opened it, I was like, oh, neat, it's a black and white, and foolishly I thought that this was like a cheaper production from the colored one, just to like get it all into one thing. That's totally not how publishing works, but I was an idiot. And I grabbed it, and I'm kind of glad, actually, because I like the black and white. I don't think there's anything wrong with the colored ones, like people can do that, can read them and be perfectly happy with them. I just think I like the black and white one. And I think I read it in early university, so I was probably like 21 or something like that, because I do remember definitely studying Latin around the time I was reading Bones. So that places it somewhere like circa 2010 or 2009, something like that.
So as I stated before, Bone originally was drawn in black and white and released that way. It was later colorized. I think it ended up being simultaneously with the later books coming out. But the colorist is Steve Hamaker, mm-hmm. or Haymaker. Don't actually know the pronunciation of his last name, so sorry if you are listening.
He's not. Who listens to this? Nobody. But anyway.
Because the artwork was originally in black and white, there's a lot of dark inks. I think the colorist mm-hmm. did a really good job as a colorist, mm-hmm. but I don't think the coloring quite matches up with the original intent or the value mapping and shape, the way shapes are supposed to work together in the original work. Even though I own the color editions, because that's what I have, I prefer the black and white illustrations. When did I first encounter this? It was in elementary school, because as the I don't know if it was the self-published volumes. I think Scholastic might have already picked it up, but it was during the time the books were coming out. It was also serialized in a magazine called Disney Adventures, which we would pick up lots of old copies of that, and there was a comic book section in there, and the colorized version of the first few chapters was included in some of the issues of Disney Adventures that I had, and those few chapters had a pretty big impact on me when I was in elementary school. I think I started drawing my own adventure comic immediately after that, but it was only like the first three or four, definitely not the whole first volume of Bone, that ended up being covered in there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't actually read it straight through beginning to end until after, well, clearly after the whole thing had come out. I was not keeping up with volumes as it was coming out through early high school. So I think I also was in university when I actually was back in the summer and was taking out the volumes put out by Scholastic that were in the library.
Mm-hmm.
So even though those are the copies that I have, I said I preferred black and white. Do you have any other comments on the color editions, Marie? Yeah.
Sure. Because there's a lot of really, most of it, I would say, is pretty white, but there's a lot of shadow contrast done with the black that I think might be a little bit like less vivid when there's also color in the picture. I think there's just a lot of visual storytelling done with blackness in this, and I think a lot of the scenes would be, I think, pretty kind of, maybe it would be more chaotic with color. I'm probably being a little bit too harsh. But it's got such a nice kind of clarity in black and white. And it's not like black and white is inevitably clear. Like, most of Akira's black and white, and I'd say that Akira is actually really hard to look at in a lot of scenes because there's too much going on. But I just sort of like how clean and easy it is, because then you're just absorbing the story as you go along.
I think another thing, too, though, is thematically, adding too much color to the illustration almost adds a certain degree of levity that's not actually in the comic. It's not a sad story. I mean, you know, insert spoiler warning here if you want, but it's not a sad story. It does have a happy ending, but by no means is it a light story. It is, I would argue, as most good children's literature is, it is quite dark and it is quite heavy. Like, there's a lot of things in it that just putting it in color, I think, almost makes it too happy, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen the color editions, Corey?
I used to sell them in the bookstore. I flipped through them once or twice, but...
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it impacts it too much, reading it in color. What it comes down to is really a matter of taste. I just prefer it as the original form that Jeff Smith put it out in. Yeah. It's closer to what his original intent was, but if the coloring makes it more appealing to its, let's face it, the target audience is like 10 to 13-year-olds.
Yeah, not small children.
It was definitely a good call if that made it more appealing to its demographic. And again, Steve Haymaker did a really good job with the actual coloring.
They do look really nice, the colored versions. They are really, really good looking. It's just a preference. There's nothing really wrong with liking the color.
Yeah, Bone came out at a really huge time for comic books. I think this is where we started calling them graphic novels in bookstores, and when libraries really started picking up and pushing various comic books. It's contemporary with Art Spiegelman and Mouse and Sandman and a bunch of other things that were coming out in the 90s and early 2000s that really changed the place of comics in North American literature, or the way it was viewed, at least from the outside.
Yeah. Well, certainly being picked up by Scholastic. I mean, you're getting pushed by, like, the people that tell you what kids' literacy is. So...
And that in itself is a huge marker, because this was originally self-published. It was coming out at the same time Cerebus was being self-published by Dave Sims. And then by the time it concluded, it was out from a major publisher and available in every high school and elementary school library across the country, United States, and in Canada, even in Whitehorse, Yukon at the time.
I think just you mentioned how it was coming out in the 90s and kind of like a golden era for comics in many ways. What I find interesting about it, too, is how atypical it is to actually kind of mainstream 90s comics of the time. I know a lot of people consider the 90s in comics to be the era of the anti-hero.
The gritty reboot.
Yeah, like everything had a gritty reboot in the 90s. Like, that's when Todd McFarlane's Spawn was very popular, for example.
Is that when Jason Todd died?
Possibly. Actually, I'm trying to remember my Batman history here, but like, then you get something like Bone, though, where it's not an anti-hero. It is very much a typical heroic story in some regards. Obviously, it's a lot more than that, which is why we're talking about it, but it kind of deviated from what was the norm at the time, and I think maybe that's part of the reason it's so well remembered, too.
I mean, I think you could reasonably call it an epic and be meeting the definitions of epic. Like, just as... is it the Iliad begins and ends with the anger of Achilles? Like, well, this begins and ends with the bones and their ability to be at home.
Well,
like, that's... The characters that changes amongst them is what defines the whole arc of the book, even though lots of other things happen. Not just because of length... But you can call it an epic, I think.
I agree that it meets the definition of an epic. Part of it, like you said, it begins and ends with a very specific thing. But another thing an epic does is it encapsulates every aspect of life. So you get something like the Iliad is one of the classic examples in Western literature. You've got everything from like these big, massive battles all the way down to people cooking and making food around the fire. And in something like Bone, you've got, which I'm sure we'll get into in a few minutes, like these big world-changing plot elements... And then you have two characters who just want to eat quiche.
Yeah. Well, one character
wants one character who wants to eat quiche.
But you also have, like, you know, love that can't really happen and
stuff. Yeah, like no, it very much encapsulates nearly every aspect of the human experience, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Smith really strikes a fine balance between the comedic and the epic, mm-hmm. and it starts out with a very narrow set of parameters, like Phone Bone got separated from the other two bones, and he's just trying to survive in the valley,
mm-hmm.
and then it just keeps on building up in terms of its scope.
Mm-hmm. It's
more and more with each passing page.
Well, I mean, it's hilarious how far it actually goes, because like you said, it starts with them being lost in the valley, and then
and they're kind of dopey. Like, it starts out pretty comedic, pretty easy to read.
Yeah, and then for the first little bit, like, the biggest stakes adventure they get into is Phony Bone tries to rig a cow race so he can scam a bunch of people out of money.
Yeah.
Right? And then from there, like, that's how it begins. By the time it ends, we're literally saving the world, so...
Yeah, then there's, you know, queens and kings and lost dragons and all kinds of stuff going on.
And quiche. Sorry, this comic, incidentally, is what got me to make quiche for the first time, and I am eternally grateful to it for that.
Thanks, Jeff Smith. I don't cook. I eat his food.
We never lose that comedic tone, even when the scope flowers out to such a huge extent by the end. The bones are still funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To the very last chapter. There's still light asides throughout.
Yeah. I think that's what makes it that someone who's like in the preteen could read it, because it has, if it was as serious as Mouse, I don't think you could sustain like a young, like all the way through, because you could take out all those fun bits and then it would be really actually pretty like dire dredge through. But I think having those beats like makes it easier to just take a break from the what's going on between Thorne and her grandmother and her duty.
What's really remarkable is how consistent it stays in its tone, despite the unraveling of the plot, despite mm-hmm. the extremely long period of time it took to make this over mm-hmm. the course of many years, mm-hmm. With Jeff Smith nearly killing himself to do it
mm-hmm.
at several points. A lot of other series that go on for this long, Cerebus is a great example. Even for this time period, a lot of series that went on for this long ended up just going completely spiraling out of control
mm-hmm.
and becoming internal exegesises for the creator by the end of them.
Yeah.
Bone never does that. Bone is always, despite its huge breadth, telling one story, picking a style, and sticking with it.
I think you can also talk about how the artwork, like, I mean, over that period of time, any artist becomes better at drawing, but he actually keeps a pretty consistent artwork the whole way through, which is...
It's executed with incredible skill from the beginning.
Yeah.
And stays that way.
Yeah, it's nice that when you, like, look at the end of the book... And at the beginning of the book, you can't, like, tell from an individual's, like, panel which one's newer and which one's older, because they look the same. That, I think, just speaks to how careful he was with selecting his character design and selecting what style he was using. And I mean, the fact that it tells one story suggests that he, you know, planned it really well ahead of time with definite, like, you know, creativity evolves, but he had at least like the end point in his mind from the beginning. Things like, I think, I don't know, Berserk just keep growing and then never really necessarily landing or finishing, and this was like something that he wanted to do.
One thing with Bone as well, you mentioned the scope, and we talked about how the stakes grow exponentially throughout. I think it's very much a testament to his skill as a storyteller. That never feels out of place.
Yeah, the stakes were always there. It's just that the characters are becoming aware of them, and we're watching them become aware of them.
Yeah, it never feels like it's too much of a jump. Like, we go from, like I said, Phony Bone rigging the cow race to saving the world, and somewhere along that track, it just feels natural for it to grow to that. It never seems like he just jumped to a big idea because he wanted to.
Yeah.
Well, it has a very keen focus on its characters, because by mm-hmm. the end of the first volume, you've met most of the important people, mm-hmm. and we end up following them the whole way through. It's not like somebody very important gets introduced at the last minute.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, everybody who you need to know is there, and we're exploring them in depth, and the narrative keeps the camera on them,
mm-hmm.
and that helps a lot.
Yeah, it's not a character study, but it is very much character-driven.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I have to bring up, when we were talking about all the careful planning, the pacing on this
mm-hmm.
is note-perfect.
Yeah, I just don't know. Just a genius. Yeah.
There are very few comics that are this well-paced.
Yeah, like, there's never a time... like. There's points where you can take a break. Like, it's not like if you open the giant tome, you're gonna go through all the pages. You certainly can. But you can stop, but you can also keep on... you can get a break. Because you just can't sustain the same thing all the time. And there's never a point where it's boring or you sort of feel like you've forgotten the plot. Because there's points where they're, you know, stuck or trapped or they have to go on a... it's not really a side quest, it's just that they can't get to their main objective, so they have to do something else, but yeah.
Well, there are natural arcs, or smaller arcs, within the bigger story, for sure. And many of those come to kind of smaller conclusions than satisfactory conclusions, where you can at least walk away from it for a little while, for sure. Like,
mm-hmm.
It never feels episodic, is what we're getting at.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nothing feels like you're taking a detour that's away from the main narrative. Everything seems like as a part, and it's playing as a puzzle piece towards the greater whole.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm just leaping through the end of part of the book here, so I'm just like, man, so good. We might have to read this again. So good. Yep. But also, the eagles don't solve the problem. So, the Battle of Five Armies is like a better resolution, as it were.
Yeah.
We were talking about the fine focus on characters earlier, and there's also that comedic balance between different kind of characters in this book. Our actual protagonist who develops the most is Thorn.
Mm-hmm.
The Three Bones, while the narrative centers around them, are largely observers and hangers-on to these other people who are important to the Valley.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, that's to help us identify with them as outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
In more ways than one, the Boneville is basically our world.
Yeah, they've got, like, banking systems and, like, stock markets in Boneville, so...
They have Moby Dick in Boneville.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's worth mentioning, too, the reason the Three Bones are not in Boneville at the beginning of the story is because Phony Bone got kicked out for attempting to rig an election.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other two Bones, who were his cousins, basically went with him for sympathy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Phone Bone went with him because he's a good person. Smiley Bone... just carried by the currents.
Yeah, Smiley Bone's interesting in that he often ends up as, like, Phony Bone's partner in crime, but he never seems as invested in it as Phony Bone does. He's just kind of going along with it.
Yeah.
Out of the three of the Bones, Smiley Bone is maybe the most interesting. Because he pals with Phone Bone, he seems like a good person, but he does things...
Yeah,
I think he's the most enigmatic of them. That's part of what makes him so interesting. It's
you never get to know Smiley Bone.
Yeah, like,
you never know him the way that you know Phony. I mean, everyone knows Phony. Yeah, everyone's met a person like Phony.
Phony
before.
Bone is really easy. He's greedy. He's self-interested. He's not actually a bad person, and ultimately does the right thing. It just takes him a while to get there.
I think that's the epic arc. Is actually Phony.
Likewise, Phone Bone is just, he's a good person. He's not a boring person, but he's the one who's always trying to do what's right.
Mm-hmm.
Smiley Bone, like you said, is very enigmatic in that you're never really sure what he's actually trying to do or what his goals are.
He's just smiling.
Yeah, he's just kind of smiling and going with the flow. Like, he's the closest to a hippie bone, I guess.
As I said, it's very effective because we're identifying with the Bones and where they're coming from, and they're being introduced into the Valley, which is this post-feudal, medieval, used to be a state, isn't really a state anymore. And they have their own religion, their own customs, all of this stuff is new to the Bones, just as it is to us.
Also, there and be dragons.
Yes.
Dragons are dragons. Important. Which is probably why I read Bone.
And rat creatures. There are also rat
ultimately,
creatures.
Ultimately, the battle between good and evil is not quite so clear-cut. It is the battle between the Lord of the Locusts and the Dragon Council that has kind of gone underground. And while the rat creatures aren't great, they are monsters, but they aren't necessarily evil.
No.
Well, the rat creatures are more... Which is funny, because they are intelligent. They do talk.
They make quiche.
They make quiche. Well, no, they like quiche, or at least one of them wants quiche. I think the one time they get quiche, someone else makes it for them. But the rat creatures aren't... They're not evil in the, like, traditional malicious sense. If anything, they're kind of more intelligent animals. They're just trying to survive, get food like many of the other characters. And it just so happened that they kind of get drawn in to serving Lord of Locusts.
Well, there's the kind of thing that about, like, you know, nurture is important. Because, like, Bartleby doesn't have the same ear shape, like, and doesn't have the same kind of, like, outwardly just gonna attack you kind of thing that the adult rat creatures seem to. Because he hasn't been, like, encultured in that kind of thing. And that comes up again later, so.
But just coming into these cultures, we are talking about world building and how Bone has a lot of it. Which is also introduced very gradually. As I said, the pacing is perfect, as is the exposition.
Like, I'm invested in that cow race. Beginning. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
We're introduced very gradually to the wider cultures and traditions. We're not hit with everything right away. Again, at the beginning, it's survival, and then we're in a village. How are the village dynamics? And after that... Oh, Grandma Ben, what's her story in the past? It starts tying into a greater mythology. Thorn, who just seems like the farm child from your fantasy novel with special abilities. It starts coming into a whole narrative and history behind her. And in many ways, Bone starts out as a low fantasy that becomes a high fantasy. And the transition is so seamless that it's not until you're at the end that you start realizing how far we've come from what this world was at the beginning.
Well, you mentioned how it starts out with Thorn as, like, the traditional farm child with special powers. Ultimately, on one level, that's really all Bone is. It's a typical fantasy narrative. But somehow, adding the Bones into it, whether it's kind of as the reader's proxy or just as this more random force, it changes the story. It takes something we're familiar with and does something very different with it. And by the time it's done, it still forms a familiar pattern and a familiar picture, but it takes a very different way of getting there and it creates something new in the process.
And I mean, we've been talking about the Bones like they're just outsiders. But Foambone and Thorn do have a pretty, like, complicated relationship. And there's a certain sense with the narrative that Thorn's arc wouldn't finish positively without Foambone being there.
Well, Jeff Smith explicitly was seeing if you could use the comics medium to tell a story as big as The Lord of the Rings. He said that in past interviews. While still calling back to... American comic traditions, like newspaper comics and that kind of thing, which is what the Bones are.
Yes.
That's what the Bones are calling back to, while what's happening in the valley in the greater narrative is a callback to the greater project that he's trying to accomplish with this.
I would argue he succeeded.
I think he did it, yeah. And I noticed we're being really careful, actually, with this one. We're not totally spoiling that much. I think we sort of would like people to just read this if they haven't yet.
No, this discussion isn't going to center around the plot points, because in many ways what makes Bone important isn't its plot. We've seen the plots that rolls out in Bone in other books, like The Lord of the Rings, maybe more explicitly like the Chronicles of Prydain.
Mm-hmm. Even like stuff like David Eddings' kind of general fantasy.
Yeah.
Well, and again, as we've said, this is not plot-wise, this is not doing anything we haven't seen before. It's a very familiar plot.
Doing it in a way that hadn't really been seen before.
Yes.
Marks its importance.
Yeah, the innovation is not in the plot, the innovation is in the approach to it, absolutely.
I think one of the things that really sort of picks out the soul is because the dragons are important, but the red dragon is comedic. As well as being a serious thing, he initially begins comedic and still has this kind of, you know, nonchalant way of sort of just wandering into the scene, wandering out of the scene throughout the whole thing. And I think that sort of makes the soul of it still a comic book, even though it's it got this narrative thing. I think it's because the thing that's like the metaphysic of your world that's like is part of the determining forces has this sense of humor.
It changes things a lot if the powerful characters are comedic. Using the Lord of the Rings parallel, if the powerful character is Gandalf, right? Somebody who's very powerful, somebody who knows they're powerful and has the ability to change the world and always takes that seriously, that tells one type of story. But if you've got a character like the dragon, who's somebody who's, again, very powerful, knows they're very powerful and can shape the world, but doesn't take themselves too seriously, it's a subtle thing, but it has a very big impact on how the story comes across.
Mm-hmm.
Everything in Bone has an inherent playfulness to it, no matter how serious the actually goings-on are. It might not even be in what the characters are saying or doing, but just how they're drawn in panel composition is often done in a fun way.
It's actually, it reminds, if you think about like Calvin and Hobbes, like any of the like Sunday comics where they have the big like background forests, gorgeous things, and then Calvin and Hobbes is the kind of cartoon character sort of just put in this like very actually serious and beautifully executed thing. It has that same kind of like grandeur in the drawing style around it.
Another good example is it starts out with the rat creatures and various other forces being after the bones, and specifically they're after Phony Bone. And it takes, I think, like two-thirds to three-quarters of the whole book before you finally figure out why they're after Phony Bone. They've just got this impression that, oh, he's important, we need to get him. And the whole time, he has no idea why he's so important. And when you finally figure out why they're after him and why they think he's important, and since we're not giving spoilers, I won't. The reason is hilarious, though.
Yeah.
Like, it's the kind of thing where if you approach it with the logic of our world or with the logic of the world the bones are coming from, it can't help but be hilarious.
Yeah.
But if you approach it with the logic of the rat creatures, it makes perfect sense, but is still hilarious.
Yeah.
So it's like,
and if you approach it with the logic of the Iliad, just wouldn't work.
Yeah, it's like, again, this whole instigating incident, the part of this thing that has the bones running for their lives.
Oh, I just remembered what it is.
Is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's funny. Oh, yeah, that's good.
But here's the thing. While ridiculous and hilarious, it doesn't in any way detract from the story. It still works very well in this universe.
I mean, by that point, everything has gone so crazy, and the stakes have become so high in terms of, like, the end of the world and good and evil, that for that to be, like, an initiating thing, you just kind of go, oh, fuck, whatever. So you just kind of keep going.
Yeah. You mentioned Calvin and Hobbes, and as Bone was coming out, it kind of had all these various connections with works that were coming out at the time. It was just bringing them together into one giant ball of stuff.
Yeah.
So we have Calvin and Hobbes, we have newspaper strips, we have the epic fantasy novels that were coming out in the 90s that were clearly influencing the shape of the plot here. We have other comics that were coming out in this scene, like Sandman, which ends up connecting to this because in some ways Sandman and Bone are kind of about the same things.
Yeah.
I think it's important because you mentioned some of the big ones. I think it's also important to include some of the very dark things that are in many ways tied into this. Like I mentioned Spawn earlier. Spawn actually kind of ties in with this. Spawn, at its core, you've got the battle of heaven and hell, good and evil, and presented in a very darkly adult way. Bone really isn't tackling any substantially different themes in some respects. Like, you're still talking about, you know, good and evil, world-changing scope. It may present it in a way that's less gratuitous and less grotesque, but it's still doing it.
There's definite, like, violence, though, like, paging through just now. Like, at the end, Thorne is seriously injured in one event. And, I mean, and it does, like, you see Thorne's character just get beaten down. Like, she gets so tired as this whole thing goes through. And that's sort of, like, what would happen to someone. I can't remember how old she's supposed to be. Is she, like, 15 or something? I'm not sure. But just how tired that someone that age with this going on would be. It's kind of accurate, I think, to what that would be like.
Yeah, the age of many of the characters is ambiguous in Bone, which is quite a bit different from how things are marketed now.
That's true.
I'm going back to Sandman because we were talking about things that look grotesque. And yeah. Sandman is a very lofty work that uses pretty shocking artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the underlying mythology of Sandman about the dreaming is also in Bone.
Yeah.
And in many ways is about the same things, but Bone is presented in such a different style. Because it's just taken Sandman and all these other influences and contemporary trends and rolling it up into one giant, consistent presentation.
Yeah.
I think going with that too, like Marie said, Thorne gets very beaten down by events in the story. And I think that's kind of the advantage of something like Bone, is that because it does kind of skew a little more towards the comedic, when you get violence happening, it doesn't need to be gratuitous to be effective. I think you could argue you feel more for Thorne, who undergoes what in the kind of the pop culture canon is fairly minor, in quotes, on the violence scale, but you feel more sympathy for that character than you do for, like, the million generic background characters that you've seen get destroyed and everything else. Like, it lacks gratuitousness, but in lacking that gratuitousness, it achieves a certain pathos.
I think, yeah, you're just saying that the sudden shift out of comedy is shocking in and of itself.
I'm not saying it's shocking, I'm saying it's effective.
I think we're saying the same thing, but anyway.
Fair enough.
In terms of its influence on later comics, like, we were talking about how many influences it rolled up into one giant package. I am not sure in American comics there is a work as influential as Bone on stuff that came out after it.
Well, I think webcomics happened.
Yes.
Is, like,
long-form webcomics owe a lot to Bone. A lot of them try and strike the same kind of tone and narrative scope as Bone does.
Yeah.
And a lot of those people, I don't think, would have started if Jeff Smith, before the time of webcomics, before the internet was a thing, tried to make a narrative that he knew no one would publish. He went out and did it anyway, published it himself, and made it a force.
Yeah.
I think part of that, and it's kind of something we're seeing with webcomics, is there's a long tradition in comics, maybe because they skew towards the speculative and the fantastic, but there's a long tradition of self-publishing. There's a long tradition of people creating their own works, and because it was never quote-unquote mainstream, or because it was never viewed as quote-unquote art, they had to create their own opportunities through self-publishing. And so in some ways, the kind of the webcomic scene that's emerged because of things like Bone is really just a continuation of that tradition.
I completely agree.
Yep, me too.
Now that we've established that I've said something that everyone agrees is right, I'm just going to quit while I'm ahead, because I'll never have you guys universally agree with me again.
So I was considering this as a generational work, and still I started talking about this with people at my job, and being sorely disappointed at the number of people who haven't
I told you
heard of Bone.
Mr. Like, everyone's read it. I was like, no, they haven't. Yeah.
I still think it's huge because You didn't get comics in school libraries mm-hmm. besides something like Asterix before mm-hmm. this.
If that.
Librarians were hugely important in spreading Bone, mm-hmm. and that's probably the Scholastic Book Fair connection working its magic right there.
Yeah.
But I think Bone is kind of instrumental in having made comics an acceptable thing for kids and teenagers to read. Mm-hmm. Before that, it would have been like, well, why are you reading comics? Read a real book.
Yeah.
And considering some of the comic books that were coming out in the 60s to the 80s, maybe people weren't wrong to think that.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases.
Batman playing baseball was not that exciting.
Yes and no. You get a lot. So you mentioned how, you know, this was very much a product of the 90s. And I'm not disputing that, but a lot of the groundwork for we see for this kind of thing to happen in comics really does come out of the 80s. We're talking about works like Mouse, and Mouse was originally published in the 80s. The Sandman kind of started in the late 80s and carried through into the 90s. A lot of important things in mainstream comics, so superhero comics, started happening in the 80s as a response to a lot of things that were happening in more independent comics to make them more of an art form. So by the time you get to the 90s, that's kind of become not established as like a full-out like pillar of the tradition the way it might be now, but you were starting to see that tradition emerge.
Yeah, the groundwork was there, but Bone became the juggernaut that rolled down the hill after.
Yeah, I mean, you can only build on what's been done before you, and I think Bone, partially because it had some very solid foundation, but not to take anything away from the work itself, partially because it did a lot with the foundation it had.
I mean, I think one of the big things is, like, Sandman and Bone and Mouse were all out at those times, but I remember when I was young, like, I would see Bone on a bookshelf. Like, it was just around more.
Yeah.
Like, I never saw Sandman or Mouse, like, around when I was, like, in my teens. Like, it wasn't, like, something that I encountered because, well, I was a born kid. But anyway.
It made comics much more visible.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it made comics much more visible to a younger audience. There's kind of this weird thing in comics, like we were saying, how for the longest time it was considered, oh, you know, something kids read comics. Comics were the introductory thing to get kids to read, but then, you know, as soon as possible, you're supposed to throw them aside and move on to actual literature. And so as you kind of go forward, like we said, with the 80s was the big decade that changed that. You get a lot of very groundbreaking comics, The Dark Knight Returns, Mouse, obviously, but you've got comics dealing with very adult things. Then you get a comic like Bone coming along, which makes it not only comics as a kid's thing, or sorry, so it does two things. It makes comics for kids again, because in the 80s there had been that big movement towards more adult comic, or more adult content.
Like heavy metal.
Heavy metal is a good example as well. But it also made comics an acceptable thing to read for kids. It made it not just, okay, read this comic until you read something real. It made it, here, this is a good thing to read.
I think we're forgetting about one comic that's actually been around for all of these and before them, also contemporaries like Batman and those kinds of comics, which kids would have read, but is a really different kind of comic. And it's sort of, I think, between the kind of, like, totally pointless, because that's Archie. Like, Archie comics, which I did read a lot of as a kid, actually. Like, many. I would buy them at the grocery store. Well, I wouldn't, my parents would, but, because those were just, like, you know, slice of life stories and a little bit of humor, and, like, not much happens in them, and I think you could reasonably say that Archie comics are kind of, like, the not-a-real-book kind of comic, but Archie's evolved, too, since then. It's had a couple reboots recently. I have not read any of them, but
Archie was the thing you let go as you grew older.
Yeah.
Bone was the book no one could let go, and that was the major difference.
I think one of the things is that, because Archie just kept trudging along and existing, and still exists. I think it's maybe less now, but I don't know. And I feel like Jeff Smith was trying to reclaim for comics the ability to tell stories that had much more, like, import and emotional feeling than Archie, because Archie doesn't have a whole lot going on in it. Like, it's pretty limp. So.
Archie is a bunch of reprints of the same strips.
over and over and over.
Repackaged into different digest editions over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Bone once I got is old the enough. Very opposite of that.
Yeah. Once you get old enough to recognize, oh, I've read this story like 5 times already. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I want to bring up the idea of Bone as a singular work. Mm-hmm. Because Jeff Smith spent a big chunk of his life working on this.
Thank you, Jeff Smith.
Hugely, hugely successful. He didn't stop making comics after this, but Bone was something he was churning around in his mind since he was in elementary school. This is very much, you know, that big story that someone's been dreaming most of their young life to put into practice, brings up the skills to be able to do it, tries a few times, and then actually executes this.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Smith didn't stop making comics after Bone, but nothing that he's made since Bone has garnered the kind of attention or gotten the kind of press and ubiquity that Bone did.
Mm-hmm.
Bone will be associated with Jeff Smith as his one magnum opus thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the only thing people associate with Jeff Smith.
I mean, if you gotta have a one-hit wonder, I don't think that's fair to Jeff Smith. I think he's... I will say I haven't... Don't think I've read much else by him, or anything else. He probably has other really good stories, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's not even fair to Bone.
Yeah.
Considering the amount of time it took to...
Yeah, you can't really call it a one-hit wonder.
I wonder if... the reason for that, like you said, this was something he spent much of his life working towards developing. I wonder if maybe because that comes across in the work.
Yeah, you get the passion.
Yeah, well, part of it is you get that it's a passion project, but it's a good passion project. A lot of things people spend a lot of time caring about don't end up mattering to anyone but themselves.
Avatar.
Yeah, sure, we could slag off numerous filmmakers, but this is an example of something where he clearly cared. He clearly cared in the sense that he wanted to make sure that when he made it, he was able to do it justice. And that carried through. He created a phenomenal work that he cared about.
Yeah. And it's also a work that is very much tied to its medium as it was originally envisioned. It is of comics.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, there's been like a spin-off middle grade novel series by some other person. There was a video game or a computer adventure game that didn't really go anywhere. They say there's going to be an adaptation of it for Netflix. But honestly,
why?
I can't... Those other spin-offs haven't been as successful, and I can't imagine Bone working outside of comics.
I can imagine an animated, potentially.
Even then, all that other stuff you're describing is unfortunately symptomatic of the culture we live in, and producers are cowards. And so rather than letting creative people create new things, they just keep insisting that people churn out what's worked in the past. But before going on that whole other rant, I think the thing with Bone, I agree with you, I can't see this working outside of a comic. Like, I can't see this working as a film. An analogy, and this is getting really different in genre now, but Cormac McCarthy's No Country for Old Men. The movie by the Coen brothers is phenomenal. It's arguably the best possible adaptation we could have gotten of the book, and it still falls short in every conceivable way. I think that's the best case scenario for a Bone adaptation. No matter how good a director, no matter how good an animator, no matter how good the quality of that movie, it will always fall short of what the book does.
I was thinking more like a series, but anyway. It might be might be reasonable as a series.
Oh, no, that's the thing. No Country for Old Men is a phenomenal movie. All right, that's how good the book is, though, that a phenomenal movie falls short of that. You can make a phenomenal Bone series, and it will still fall short. That's how integral the medium is to the work.
I was just thinking, you could make, probably, I think, for Bone, you'd need to do, like, a serial.
And
a single thing would just, it'd be like, this would be like the couple of Dune films, right? Like, it's pretty hard to do.
Well, there's a reason epics don't translate to film well.
But I do think that if you made a really good series, and it was good, it would probably just be reductionist. It would be like, what, we already had that.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time that Bone started, this was the only way something like Bone could come out.
And now that,
as a comic.
And now that I'm thinking about it, once you have the voices, the voice actors will need to pick an age for the characters.
Yeah.
And the fact that you don't really know how old Thorne is or how old her grandmother is, I think that's actually kind of like helps because they sort of fluidly move between a couple of different kind of stages at various points.
Yeah, the problem with an adaptation is there's so many interpretive choices you need to make that they can't help but contradict. Some of them can't help but contradict each other.
Hmm.
I think, like you mentioned, Michael, the artwork is so integral to this story. Being
mm-hmm.
a comic is so integral to this story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can't conceive of this as a novel. Frankly, I think it would be mediocre to bad as a novel, whereas it's phenomenal as a comic.
It could be a good audiobook.
Hey,
some people will not be able to read it, as it is. I'm just saying. Accessibility matters, guys.
After I read Bone, it was a very long time before I found anything that captured that feel or just that level of craft that I felt with Bone. And before we started this podcast, I started rereading Bone, and I thought, I'll just read the first volume.
Can't
and
that'll
do just that. Get me up to speed on some of the artwork, and it'll be good. And now I'm on volume 7. I wasn't able to finish it in time for the podcast, but you can still read as a good clip. And before we concluded, I also wanted to bring up something that a comics author, Canadian comics author named Faith Erin Hicks brought up, that this took a really long time to make. And a lot of time artists who work in comics kind of lament at how quickly people go through these when they put in so much blood and sweat and tears to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And she had the same thought, but her mind has changed on that.
Mm-hmm.
She goes, it's the strength of the comics medium that you can fit even though Bone is 1,200 or 1,300 pages altogether or whatever,
mm-hmm.
the actual story is probably worth several thousand pages.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you can fit that in there and read it in a week
mm-hmm.
is the strength of the comics medium in long-form serious narratives like this.
Oh, yeah. Like, all the gesture that you don't have to describe. You can see the village in one panel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's so much that's able to be done. And the fact that, I mean, there's a lot of things that are churned out pretty quickly in comics. Like, people don't necessarily go back and reread those a whole lot. But it's like you went back to, you know, just check on the thing you'd read before, but it pulled you back in. It is so good and, like, gripping as a story.
I think something to consider, too, and this might be part of the reason comics were dismissed as a medium for so many years. People take the attitude that if everything is visually handed to you, then there's no imagination, there's no mental engagement. I think Bone is a perfect argument that that's not the case at all. While there's certainly some not very well done comics where that's the case, something like Bone, you see the whole village. All the information is presented to you at a glance, but there's something in the way it's presented where it still triggers your imagination, it still engages you, it still creates a sense of interest.
I mean, there's the sounds, the smells. Like, all the,
yeah,
the motion, like, how the motions are happening in between panels is it's still a part of that. That's one of the things where, like, Jeff Smith accomplishes it, but Uderzo, who I don't know if Uderzo's still alive, actually.
Oh,
like,
Asterix.
Gassini and Uderzo?
Yeah, the Gassini's dead. Uderzo, I think, might still be alive, but I'm not sure, actually. But he similarly was able to do that, just the perfect transition between panels for the action to, like, flow naturally and for you to see, like, how the one became the next with just the right sort of, like, frame rate, in a way.
Mm.
Well, it's safe to say we all recommend this book.
Yeah, it's great.
I had just assumed everybody our age had read it, but
yeah, that's
apparently
you
that's
have
not
a...
the case.
It's just because you have a limited number of friends that you talk
to.
Well,
again, I was in my late 20s, early 30s before I read this. So I don't know that it's necessarily as ubiquitous as you think. I will argue it's influential.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of this weird thing where the works that are very influential and the works that are ubiquitous that everyone knows about are not always the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's bizarre. It's like everyone you might read and love has probably read this. but you may not have heard of it yourself.
I would say for all the people who haven't read Bone, or for those of us who have and want other people to read it, it is good enough that you could probably hand it off to most people and they start reading it and then get swept away and read it, because it's pretty easy to get into and it's just so well done.
Well, it's easy to get into and hard to put down.
Yeah.
Like
as much as it's like a fantasy narrative, it's still just about regular human things, like all fantasies are, but very accessibly so, I'd say.
I think there's a few things about it. It's very accessible, for one. It deals with very kind of personal things that most people, I think, could relate to. And it does something very interesting. It strikes a perfect balance that a lot of works strive for but fail to achieve, in that it takes on very serious things without ever losing its sense of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The level of craftsmanship and passion in this work has not been equaled in a long time.
Yeah,
like, you talk about those of us who work in the arts, the arts, if you will, we always talk about the craft of doing something, the craft of writing. And I think Bone is very much a perfect example of someone who mastered their craft.
Yeah.
That was episode 40
yeah.
of the One Last Sketch podcast. Thank you for listening. Get Bone, if you haven't already.
Make a quiche.
Yeah, thanks for listening to us just say this book's great for however long this podcast will end up being.
Quiche.
Yeah, and just keep on striving against those stupid, stupid rat creatures. You can get past episodes of our podcast from onelastsketch.wordpress.com. We're also on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and I think it's called Google Podcasts now. They keep on changing it.
Yeah, whatever.
You can follow me on Twitter, DeviantArt, Mastodon, and Instagram as One Last Sketch. Where can we find you guys?
Well, I am. I do have the somewhat archival, but hopefully not purely archival blog at yatropexy.wordpress.com. Also at the new website shrinkandexpand.com.
My attempts at creating an online presence failed spectacularly, so I'm not currently maintaining any online personas, but stay posted. I may try again.
Oh, hey, you can also follow me on Twitter at shrinkandexpand.
And I have a plug. I am in Tesseract 22, the next anthology of Canadian science fiction fantasy. This one's called Alchemy and Artifacts. If you want to read the stories, there's one in there.
He's thanks a good for writer, listening. Guys. Go read his
We name. Don't know when our Lex episode will be, but maybe but there will be one.
I'm betting or hoping for Full Metal Alchemist.